Talk given Sunday, 23rd March, 1980. Now, during all these years, we have considered some of the deepest things in a religion. And in what constitutes religious living as such. We have also considered so many problems and their resolution. We have tried to obtain even a passing glimpse, but I trust a true glimpse of the purpose and meaning of life, a glimpse of a vision of the art of living religiously, so that life's trend and purpose may fulfill itself through us. And we have tried in our little way to sense transcendence and what that sense of transcendence, if it begins to stir within us, can do, not just for us, but for our whole environment. Now, so much of what I have said during these years has been of the nature of an ascesis. And, you know, the word asceticism is derived from ascesis, the Greek ascesis, which means allowing all the unessentials to drop away from us and leave us free of conflicts, illusions, false images regarding ourselves and those around us and the world in general, and enslaving identifications, our identifications with our interests, our nation, our creed, our caste, our beliefs, our convictions, and so on. Because these identifications with the particular around us means that inside ourselves a separation has been effected. We identify ourselves with this, but we exclude that. And that is no way to heal. Because if there is to be a healing, a whole making, everything has to be included. Nothing has to be excluded. Now, of course, this will raise various questions in one's mind. And as they come up in your mind, write them down and let me know about it. Also, to leave us free, at least in some extent, to some extent, of the killing burden of unnecessary sorrow. This is a very important point. Because man is in such sorrow, he does so much evil. He cannot help himself. Now, this is one of the meanings of living the ascetic life, letting all unessentials drop away. And we have to be very, very observant, intensely mindful, in order to see these unessentials, recognize them, and not try to get rid of them, but see them so clearly, so truthfully, for what they actually are, that they naturally drop away. See, just like if a portion of the skin produces a scab, in due time, that scab falls away by itself. You can, of course, tear it out or do something like that, but often that only produces another one. But it falls away naturally. And this is a very important point, so that we get, so that there is a true healing taking place in the psyche. The question is, have we in this process become happy ascetics? Because people practice an asceticism, deliberately try to get rid of something, and they think of it as an awful cost. Something very difficult to get rid of. They call it a sacrifice. And that is no sacrifice. A sacrifice is a joyful thing. It is a making sacred, a making whole. And it happens naturally by itself, if we are attentive in the right way. Have we become free human beings? And freedom is a word which in our day and age and amongst all of us is one of the most misunderstood. In fact, freedom in modern times can easily be spelled L-I-C-E-N-S-E. Or CE, isn't it? License. Two C's, yes. You see? Or instead of becoming free, have we become truly free, or have we given a mere intellectual assent to what we desire to keep on grasping for ourselves? I'm referring here particularly to our beliefs and our convictions, which have no warrant in truth in its real sense. But we cling on to our beliefs. I get frequent instances of this. Oh yes, Firuz denies rebirth and all that sort of thing, but they continue to believe in rebirth. And why do they continue to believe in rebirth? Because they want their wages for their good deeds and nothing for their ill deeds. Somebody else can receive the wages for that. You see? Please don't feel I'm being very harsh. I think it is essential to see the naked truth, not a wrapped up truth. A truth wrapped up in our in order to pander to our desires and ambitions and so forth. It's a very difficult task. And especially our clinging to our beliefs in an entity self. We may think that we do not believe in an entity self. We say, oh yes, of course, the Buddha taught that none of the constituents which make up the living person, the existent here on earth, is permanent. It all fades away, completely fades away. We may say that, yes, we believe that, believe the Buddha's word, but in actual fact we live exactly as if we did believe in a permanent entity inside ourselves, which will reap the benefits of the good we have done. We remain shopkeepers, spiritually and intellectually, all throughout our lives. There is no getting away from that fact. Face it squarely and clearly. Or shall I put it this way? Face it squarely so that ultimately one sees the fact with complete clear-sightedness. There are no illusions left, no clouds left. It is really a cloudless sky when the mind is absolutely clear-sighted. And that's very important. But how many of us do that? Consider, for example, the way we get tied up with our particular interests, our particular good causes, and so forth. These identifications and the belief that this is a good cause always in the subconscious, in the spirit of, it is against a bad procedure, a bad cause which is going on. Take this business of the killing of whales and these little dolphins and so on, you see. Yes, of course it's bad, of course it is evil. There's no getting away from the fact. But see the fact without cutting oneself off from it. You are on that side of the fence, I am on this side of the fence. And everything on this side of the fence is where God is. And on the other side is the devil, you see. Well, you'll never heal or cure the devil and his hosts unless we are completely self-involved with them. That is to say, we do not shut ourselves out as the righteous ones, the good ones. Do right without feeling self-righteous. And especially we cling to the belief that if we keep on striving and going through all these conflicts and so on, we shall ultimately reach a postulated nirvana or a kingdom of heaven. There is no such place to which any of us can go in any sense whatsoever. The reality of transcendence will shine through each and every one of you, and that will be the manifestation of nirvana if each and every one of us is free of all defilements, completely purified. No mistake about that. Now, perhaps you might begin to appreciate why I am so utterly uncompromising with the things I try to put before you. Bear in mind that with all our strivings and our conflicts, we release an energy out of our own living being which maintains that striving and conflict. But this type of energy is something which peters out. It comes to an end. Now, the energy which is which is associated with the primordial creative energy itself, with transcendence itself, with the ultimate truth, that energy is infinite. It is self-replenishing. The energy which we release through striving and conflict is not self-replenishing at all. It is something which expends itself, and it's like a stream in the desert. It wastes away as a stream, you see. But the energy which belongs to the realm of the transcendent is infinite, and it is self-replenishing. Our energy, which we release, expends itself in asserting our separate selfness. And the sphere in which this energy functions is rather a large sphere. It's the sphere of the entire Big Bang. You know what science says nowadays, that the Big Bang has produced the entire universe. 2,000 million galaxies all going away from each other, dispersing out. And it also teaches that in the end, what happens with all these wonderful stars and so on, they become black holes. And everything sort of swirls down that gully, and time goes backward, and all sorts of queer things happen. Now, this Big Bang is our total sphere. It's the sphere of manifestation. You see? And so, our selfness has quite a good deal of room in which to express itself. the big I am. As you see, this is in complete contrast to the energy of transcendence itself. What is called Kundalini is very much misunderstood and misdirected and misapplied in the world. Be very careful of that, and be very careful of saying that, this which I am doing is one of the effects of the rousing of Kundalini. Nothing of the sort. Well, the ill effects I am talking of, and people getting a bit potty and ill and all the rest of it. Put all that aside. Just do the right thing. Let the process of purification go on, and you may find that transcendent energy will function through you. And then you'll know precisely what that is. All the rest is illusion. Be very careful about these things. It is the clinging to the illusions which we have which produces so much the bulk of our unnecessary sorrow, which I referred to a little while ago. This transcendent energy acts not in time, it acts in eternity. And we have touched upon this matter before. Eternity is not the opposite of time, nor is it the opposite of timelessness. Don't make the mistake of identifying timelessness with eternity. Timelessness is bound within time. It is a word which we use because of our human experience of timelessness. It starts at a particular time, on a particular day, as you enter into the profoundest meditative state, or when your attention is completely occupied with whatever it may be. Completely occupied. When that takes place, the time consciousness ceases to function, and the timeless state is being experienced. But that timeless state comes to an end simply because the timeless state which arises when you are in the profoundest meditative state, it comes to an end because the body must assert its needs. You can't go on forever. The Buddha himself said, for instance, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 7 days and nights. And it's a state of blissfulness, of blissful peace. That is the sort of state in which one is. This is the supreme yogic condition, actually. The condition of the completely alone. Just as transcendence itself is the alone, meaning not separated from anything, but the one only, the one total reality, the absolute fact, the undeniable fact. And you know that the word I in Sanskrit, aham, means essentially the undeniable. And it is the correspondent of the Kabbalistic Ehyeh, I am, the I am. And Yahweh, Jehovah, has the same root as Ehyeh. It's a very interesting point, that. Now, this functions, therefore, in eternity. And functioning in eternity, it has no continuity. Only that which functions in terms of time, or in terms of that which is bounded by time, and also therefore associated with a particular space and a particular occasion, has a continuity. But this has no continuity. The absolute is is unthinkable, unimaginable. If and when somehow this thing touches you, I have several times used the phrase, the lightning of transcendence strikes you. And you know, in Mahayana Buddhism, for instance, you find this relationship with lightning, with fireflies, and that sort of thing coming in the Prajnaparamita. The lightning of transcendence touches you, and it just happens, and you know. And it is a knowing which is quite different, utterly different from knowing with the brain. It is a totally different knowing. It is a knowing which has been presented in Mahayana as the sarvajñādhyāna, the all-knowing knowledge. There is that other word for knowledge, vidya. And vidya means literally seeing, seeing completely, totally. And that that total seeing is one of the meanings of the term omniscience, which we use in connection with the perfected holy ones, in connection with our theological presentations of God or the ultimate or whatever it may be. Now, this primordial creative energy acting in eternity is identical with the supreme I Am, the Ehiye of the Kabbalah, the Aham Me of the Zarathustrians, and the Aham of the Vedic writings. They are an identity. And as such, it is identical with consciousness in its absolute state, its absolute condition. Absolute consciousness and this primordial creative energy are an identity. They are one and the same. Now, bear in mind that a dual process takes place through the activity of this primordial creative energy in eternity. Energy differentiates, and simultaneously this absolute consciousness proliferates. I use two different words, and if you sort of look deeply enough into the meanings of the word differentiation and the word proliferation, you'll appreciate why I use the two words. As the primordial creative energy differentiates, it itself is undifferentiated, just as absolute consciousness is undifferentiated. When the differentiation takes place, accompanied by the appropriate proliferation of consciousness, grosser and grosser forms of expression out of the original absolute take place. And so all the different types of forces, energies, and manifestations come into being. And they culminate in what we commonly call matter, energy by differentiation, completely concretized is what we call matter, solid, liquid, gaseous, and consciousness by proliferation, ultimately turns around the bend, so to say, because plants, animals also display consciousness, and in human beings that consciousness is not merely a consciousness which is simply receptive, receiving impressions and automatically responding to them, but has become a separative and an isolative consciousness. It is separative with respect to the things that that constitute the universe. Objects are all separated, and persons, all persons are isolated. I am John Smith and not William Brown. That sort of isolatedness. Now this is the sort of nadir of this process of manifestation. So you see what the Big Bang is responsible for. It's quite extraordinary. You might say, am I sort of presenting a new philosophy or a new ontology? It is perfectly true that the modern world needs a new ontological presentation, because there is nothing in terms of the religious life and in terms of the development and fulfillment of human beings which is devoid of an implied ontology. There is always an implied ontology, and it is helpful to, in some way or other, to be aware of this and the nature of this ontology. Ontology is the understanding of ultimate things. You see, it deals with that aspect of philosophy which deals with ultimate reality and so forth. That is why I am saying all these things, because it has definitely a practical result in our living process. When this dual process starts, the differentiation of energy and the proliferation of consciousness, we get the first transcendent dual, which is termed Bina in the Kabbalistic teachings, which is presented as Prakruti, primordial nature, as the Indians themselves translate it in the Vedic teachings. It comes in the Sankhya philosophy particularly, but is implicit in the whole of the Vedanta also. Prakruti, because I say this because Prakruti, like Bina, consists of both positive and negative elements, and the male and female, in what I have called timeless conjugation. This timeless conjugation, which produces or releases the innumerable things and phenomena and everything that exist in the universe. You see? So the transcendent dual, which also is the transcendent hermaphrodite, the male-female in timeless conjugation, comes into being, and the whole process, the universal process, comes out. It gives rise, on the one hand, to what corresponds on the cosmic level to what we see and experience on the limited particular level, through our sense perceptions and our discriminative consciousness at work, and our logical intellectual processes. Now I have said all this because it is necessary to understand the nature of this dualism as best we can. In connection with this dual process presented in philosophic terms, meditate upon the double helix of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, the double helix. And it is so intimately connected with our living, with the living process of the cell, of the cells which compose our bodies and so forth. Meditate also in this connection upon the Ida and the Pingala nadis. There again you get a double helix working up. Some say there isn't a helix. Some say that the Ida and the Pingala nadis go straight up. Be that as it may, it is just as likely that it is a double helix activity. And the unification of it, the primordial, corresponding to the primordial creative energy, the one only, the alone, the absolute, is this rising of Kundalini in the Sushumna nadi. And that implies the release of transcendence in the manifested. That is why it is considered the supreme height of the yogic practice. And when Shakti rises up and meets her Lord, as they say, Shiva, in Sahasrara, there is the permanent union. There's such a lot which one can understand and see in this connection. But be careful not to spin cobwebs of imaginary processes which are not there, but which the brilliance of a brain can easily let loose upon oneself or upon those around us. Much of the stuff which has been produced in recent years about it all is just stuff. So beware of it, leave it aside. Now let us then come back to this point, that the energy of the absolute, the original creative energy, is infinite and self-replenishing, and the energy produced by our strivings and conflicts and our efforts to get rid of this, that, or the other, or to acquire this, that, or the other. These two energies are not unrelated, for the very simple reason that it is, in the first instance, this primordial creative energy which gives rise to us ultimately, and we produce this energy which peters out. The two are related. If there were not this relationship, there'd be absolutely nothing for us. Because we, as we are, cannot touch that transcendence. It is that transcendence which touches us, as and when we have so purified ourselves that we do not release any more of this energy which peters out. This is where seeing the truth begins to have meaning in terms of religious living. The seeing of the truth is of the most fundamental importance. Wisdom, in other words. And in the Kabbalah too, you will find the same thing. Chokhmah, wisdom, is really takes first place. And it is the influence of this wisdom at the cosmic and transcendent level which so stimulates Bina, which contains both the male and the female, the positive and the negative, that the whole evolutionary process starts up. So wisdom is the most important. When Jesus said, "My Father in heaven, Abba, the Son of the Unknown, the Son of the Absolute, in heaven, in Chokhmah," You see, this is very important. Now, there are those who might say that this transcendent energy, which is something absolute, has no relationship to our energy which we release through our activities and which peters out. Now, I say no. I say that these two, there is a relationship between these two energies, because if there were no relationship, the transcendent would not be subsuming all of us and everything else. And without our being subsumed by the absolute, it is impossible for any sort of realization to take place. You see? Now, when one does get touched by these things, somehow or other, then one, then all the ordinary beliefs and convictions that we have, like scabs on the mind, just naturally fall off. They have fulfilled. They were there because we were ill in the mind. Dukkha, one of the deep meanings of dukkha. And so those scabs fall off. You see? And this, the relationship between being and non-being becomes clear to us. I can assure you this is a fact. It does become clear to us. We cling to being, and when we cling to being, what do we cling to? Our personal entity existence as such. I, John Smith, everlastingly was John Smith and will be John Smith, of course in heaven ultimately, because I'm such a good person. And that sort of almost idiotic belief has captivated mankind all through the ages. Being and non-being are an identity, and yet they are separate in a sense. The pulse of creation pulsates between being on the one hand and non-being on the other hand. If there were no relationship between them, in the Gita, Sri Krishna could never have said, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. Non-being is not annihilation, not non-existence, a complete non-existence. An utter vacuity. It isn't that. It is a reality. Now, obviously, it's only transcendence, the totality, which is infinite and as such is non-particular being. See, being implies particularity. And so each one of us who is aware of himself, and quite naturally and rightly, as a particular being, if he begins to understand this and respond to it, he will never fear death. In reality, he will see that this being just becomes the non-being. That doesn't mean that I, as Firoz Mehta, will exist as Firoz Mehta in the state of non-being. That non-being is infinite. It belongs to the context of eternity, of immortality, whereas the finite, the temporal and the mortal is that which is manifested here in the process of manifestation. And it is all completely subsumed within the transcendent. Now, if we can sort of begin to get hold of this in some degree or other, see into the reality of it, see into the truth of it, then the living of the religious life becomes is on a sounder basis. You know what must fall away from you, all the different scabs in the psyche, thereby enable pure mind to function freely through you, thus fulfilling the purpose of your own existence and bringing to fruition yourself as well as the trend of life functioning through the species called man, created in the living likeness of the Supreme.